Looking out over the City of Angels on a warm winter night, what do you see?
Hi, can I ask you a question for the takeaway?
Sure.
All right, you see all those lights out there?
Absolutely.
It's Los Angeles, right?
Yeah.
How many of those lights do you think are, like, wasted energy?
I'd say a good portion, maybe, I don't know, 3/4 of it.
Do you think some of them are wasted energy?
Yeah, probably.
Technically, you could turn all of them off.
What I want you to do, I want you to tell LA to turn the lights off.
Don't turn on your lights and waste energy. Yeah.
Hey, guys, if there's any lights you don't really need to use, help us out with the energy and turn them off.
Turn your lights off! Just turn them all off right now! Shut the power switches down! It's not hard! Turn them off!
Like that energy. Not bad, but can our listeners across the country do better? Live from LA and New York, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, February 5th, and John is joining us from Los Angeles today. Good morning, John.
Now, the lights are starting to go off, although it's still pretty dark here.
Good morning to you, and good morning to everyone. We take a hard look at the executive salary cap President Obama says is necessary and fair. Also, the latest on Iraq's elections. There are no official results yet. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
President Obama is attending the annual National Prayer Breakfast this hour. He's then expected to announce the creation of a Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. It's part of his efforts to overhaul the current White House Office of Faith-Based Initiatives that was formed by President Bush. The president has also signed a bill that will extend health coverage to 4 million uninsured children. He says the new law is a key step toward universal health care coverage.
I am confident that if we work together, if we come together, we can finally achieve what generations of Americans have fought for and fulfill the promise of health care in our time.
The bill calls for more than $32 billion to fund an expansion of the state Children's Health Insurance Program, or SCHIP. It's funded by an increase in tobacco taxes.
Meanwhile, the Senate continues their back and forth on the economic stimulus bill today. Lawmakers added a provision yesterday that provides a tax credit for new home buyers. They also voted to soften a Buy America clause in the plan to comply with international trade agreements. Democratic leaders hope to bring the bill to a vote in the Senate by the end of the week. Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska says he's part of a bipartisan group of lawmakers working to find support for the plan.
Yeah, I know you're all going to ask what we're going to call the group. The word gangs has been a little overused, but how about Job Squad? This is about jobs, jobs, jobs.
The Job Squad. Many Republicans object to the amount set aside for spending in the bill, which tops $920 billion. A Ukrainian merchant ship that's been held by pirates since September is finally free. The ship's owners say they paid a ransom. The ship was loaded with military goods that some thought might fall in the hands of those Somali pirates. John?
The S&P, after falling 1% yesterday, starts trading at 832. And you heard those strong voices screaming at the people of L.A. to turn off wasted lights. Well, it didn't probably do much. But you're energy conscious. What do you do when you see other people wasting energy? Do you notice buildings with lights on at night? What would you do about it? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Get on a power trip. Tell us how to change energy.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
For top executives to award themselves these kinds of compensation packages in the midst of this economic crisis isn't just bad taste, it's bad strategy, and I will not tolerate it as president.
Today may be a new day for some executives on Wall Street. President Obama has announced a new cap on executive pay for those companies getting federal bailout money. Executives in those companies can only make up to $500,000 a year under the rule, which for the majority of Americans is an enormous amount of money, but it's not compared to the tens of millions some company heads have gotten in the past. The president's rule may go over well on Main Street, but it has not gone over well on Wall Street. The real question is, though, will it help the economy? Compensation experts Nell Minow, co-founder of the Corporate Library and Independent Research Firm, and Charles Elson, director of the Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware, join us now to take a look at the merits of this plan. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Nell, you support the cap. Why?
Well, it's really not right to call it a cap. It's just a cap on cash compensation. There's no limit whatsoever on a bonus in the form of stock. The problem is that the stock does not vest until the government has been taken out and paid off, and that it cannot be sold. And I think that that's a great bonus. It doesn't limit how much they can make. It just makes their interests aligned with those of shareholders and taxpayers.
Charles, you have an entirely different view. What do you think of this rule?
Well, I agree with Nell that a stock-based component makes a lot of sense, and I'm also in agreement that the bonuses were this year particularly outrageous and selfish and rather arrogant. I just don't think that an artificial cap on pay makes a lot of sense, really for two different reasons. First of all, I think that there is the danger, unfortunately, when you set a limit, an arbitrary limit on something, that people, don't work for you. They go somewhere else. They, quote, brain drain. I think that's a concern. I think the other concern, though, is evasion. I think that any time you set a fixed rate, people always work very hard to work around it, and they evade it. And that's, I think, what happened back in 1993 when we tried to do something. Well, it's not exactly the same thing, but something kind of similar. People simply work their way around the limits. I just think that the key is flexibility, and I think the key is flexibility for a group who we have trust in to do the right thing, the board of these banks, which unfortunately to this point haven't done a very good job. I think our efforts should be focused on reforming them as opposed to setting arbitrary limits.
Well, Charles, maybe the way to reform them is to actually have a brain drain. Maybe we don't need these brains, and we could use some different brains. And as for evading the cap, it seems to me, and Nell sort of alluded to this, that it's not really much of a cap. It only applies to executives from here on out. It doesn't apply to executives who have already received these bonuses and already have their salaries set. And it also seems to only apply to the exceptional circumstance category of money and not to all of the TARP money that goes into some of these financial institutions. Charles?
Well, yeah, I would agree. The current management, I don't think we should feel particularly happy about rewarding. And I think it probably in most of these places is time for fresh talent. But I think when you go out to look for fresh talent, again, setting an arbitrary limit, a cash limit at $500,000, I just think could make trouble. Obviously, there will be some people who say no problem, but there may be a
I'll say no problem.
Say no.
I mean, I'll say no problem right off the top.
But hey, listen, I'm an academic. They could pay me a lot less if I'd show up. But nonetheless, I think that any time you set an arbitrary limit, you limit the pool of people you can bring in. And I think it sounds great. It goes right to a populist appeal. But I think sometimes populist solutions may backfire, and I worry about the unintended consequences.
Charles, go ahead now.
I don't agree with my very good friend Charles on this one thing. You know, it's important to remember the government is not acting here as a regulator or as an enforcement arm. It's acting as a business entity. You know, if these companies went to anybody, whether they went to KKR, a private firm, or whether they went to the mob, you know, anybody to loan the money, they would have to give something back. They would have to make concessions about pay. And so this is a very limited, very targeted, very moderate approach that I think will restore credibility. Remember the last time the government did a bailout? That was Chrysler, the then unthinkable amount of $1.5 billion. First thing that happened, Lee Iacocca took a dollar a year and escalated stock options. And you know what? He did very, very well out of it, and so did the taxpayers.
Let's investigate for a second, Charles, your notion of populism, and let's listen to how the president takes a look at populism, but also wraps that into one of the tenets of capitalism.
What gets people upset, and rightfully so, are executives being rewarded for failure, especially when those rewards are subsidized by U.S. taxpayers, many of whom are having a tough time themselves.
Isn't that really the bottom line, Charles? And then the question is, what is the policy to address those differences?
Well, you know, I think my concern here, and I think the group you haven't heard much about, are the shareholders of these beleaguered institutions, who happen to be all of us, because they're extremely widely held. I mean, it's almost not everyone in America has stock in these places, but certainly a lot of people do. I just have belief that, frankly,
we do now.
Well, they do. I have a lot of faith, ultimately, in a board of directors doing the right thing and people acting in good, quote-unquote, in good taste. In other words, I think most of the executives of these places should have taken pay cuts voluntarily.
But they didn't. And they haven't.
But the problem is that in the U.K., when the government bailed out the financial institutions, they took voting stock. The U.S., we took non-voting stock. So U.K., they are making amendments to the boards. Of course, the first thing we should do is focus on these boards of directors. And I would really hope, Charles, that you and your fellow Delawareans would make some changes to the rules so that shareholders could throw out boards of directors by not reelecting them. Right now, it's just too hard to do that. It's just about impossible.
Well, I agree with you, and I think the real change, to me, the focus needs to be on boards, a la independence, ownership, and changing the rules of elections to make it easier to place directors. I think that the shareholders of these banks, frankly, should get together at some point and say enough and bring some other people in.
But and Charles, what role does the government have in that, if any?
Well, I think that given where these stocks have fallen, I think it's a pretty easy thing for the shareholders to be extraordinarily dissatisfied. And if you take a look at any discourse in the popular media and the financial media, I think you've got a lot of very angry people. There's a campaign out there to replace the CEO of one of these banks. Apparently, that began. And you know, I think that it's happening now. I'm concerned ultimately that if you get down talent out of these places and make it harder to invest in these places down the road, the real danger is the future of private investment in any enterprise, which I think would be very harmful to all of us long term. That's my
concern. Well, now let me focus that then on you. I mean, the real question, sort of structurally, for Barack Obama is: does this kind of a strategy actually restore confidence, stop the sort of anger that Charles is talking about, or does it actually put blood in the water and cause the sharks to kind of circle and ultimately we get the pitchforks out and then we're in a whole other situation?
Listen, I think we would have had the pitchforks out if he hadn't done something. So I think it is a very modest, very measured, very fair approach that, as I said, does not limit pay. It just aligns it with shareholder interests and taxpayer interests. It's a very short-term approach. And I really like the second part of his announcement yesterday, which is that he's going to undertake a more substantive and comprehensive study of this issue and make some changes going forward. You know, he was a sponsor when he was a senator of the Say on Pay legislation, which would give shareholders an advisory, non-binding vote on executive compensation. I think that's a good approach, too.
And Charles, what do you think the government should be focusing on? If not the compensation issues, then what?
I think the focus needs to be on oversight, the oversight of the group that was there to begin with to make sure this didn't happen, which were the board's directors. I think ultimately they're the shareholders' best friend and, frankly, the taxpayers, if it's done right. And I'm afraid if we get into prescription on things like pay and whatnot, I think we lose sight of the bigger question and the bigger problem, which are boards that who are there on the ground in these institutions. The system was built around that, to operate effectively. And I agree with Nell. I think changes in Delaware law vis-a-vis elections should be forthcoming. But again, I don't want us to lose track and lose focus. That's what happened in 1993, and that's why we're in this mess right now. I think we lost focus on the ultimate problem, which is the oversight vehicle. If we can fix that, I think the rest falls into place.
I think all of us, everyone, would agree that there is certainly a big mess here. And Nell Minow, editor and co-founder of the Corporate Library, an independent research firm, and Charles Elson, director of the Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware, we thank you for your discussion this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And John, you've been on the West Coast. I think they are still. Clearly have differences, as many people do, but this is not something that's going to be solved in 8 minutes here on The Takeaway. But what we can solve is what you've been doing in Los Angeles, your mission.
Well, we can't solve anything, but we can certainly learn some interesting lessons. You know, there's a sociology and psychology in this as much as there is the science of making new energy production. And that's what we're going to discover as we visit areas that are trying to encourage people to make different energy choices as well as developing new forms of energy entirely. It's an interesting trade-off.
And we're asking for people's pet peeves on energy. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
So, good morning, everyone. I'm out here in Los Angeles, as we've mentioned, on what we're calling a power trip. Isn't there some other public radio show which has a host in Los Angeles and one on the East Coast? I can't remember the name. Anyway, we're out here this week to take a look at some revolutionary energy technologies. And, Adora, as we've mentioned all week, there's a lot of science involved in developing new forms of energy, but there's also science, call it sociology or psychology, of understanding how we all use energy. For instance, what if we knew virtually every second of our waking lives how much energy we were using? How would that change things? Well, a company in Redwood City, California called Centilla is developing devices, extremely smart energy meters, to start to answer that question. Joe Pilastri, the chief technical officer and co-founder, who looks like he could be my son, says, "The reason I don't know much about my own energy consumption is because the meter on my house is actually keeping me ignorant."
Well, the problem is your meter only tells you when you get electricity over the course of an entire month. So you get your bill and you look at it and you say, "Hey, wait, what actually used that electricity? Was it my fridge? Was it my dryer?" You don't know. And what you really need is granularity to know exactly where and when your energy is consumed.
And not only don't I know with any sort of granularity which appliances are using all of the power, but industries don't know, companies don't know, neighborhoods don't know, cities don't really even know.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it's not just you as a consumer, but think about, you know, manufacturing things that we use like metals and aluminum, or whether it's, you know, just sitting in commercial buildings and the millions of those that we have across this country.
So you're basically describing an America of electrical consumers who talk a lot about being green these days, but essentially they're all blindfolded.
Well, they don't have the information that they need to actually take action. I think if I asked you tomorrow, reduce your energy use by 20%, you wouldn't know where to start with that.
I would have no idea. I would have absolutely no idea. I mean, I'd turn off the fridge and then all the food would rot. And
that's usually what most people do, or turn down the thermostat maybe by a couple of degrees. But the reality is it might have been, you know, that clothes dryer you had that's been totally outdated and you bought it in the 1970s.
So what is it exactly that you're selling besides just this idea that we need information?
Well, Centilla is really a software suite that analyzes all of your energy use. So it starts down with a computer physically about the size of a quarter, but it's really small, and it allows us to now put this into a device. It looks like a plug or a wall wart that you would plug in, and you plug your appliance into this. And what that does is then wirelessly transmit all of this energy information back to the internet, and you go to a web page, and it shows you in real time, here's all of the energy you're consuming, here's some recommendations of how you might want to reduce your energy use, and here's the trend, so you know if your energy use is actually increasing or decreasing over time with the changes that you're making.
And I'd buy enough of these boxes to cover my major appliances, all my appliances, the circuits in my house. How would I do it?
Well, ultimately, you would want to cover every single outlet you have, every single piece of equipment. You would want to know exactly where all of your energy is going, because you may not realize that something is a big consumer of energy because you haven't considered it before. So the goal is really, really high granularity, and Centilla's system right there provides that at each piece of equipment or appliance or anything that has a plug in your house.
So it sounds like what you're telling me is that in the future, and maybe even the very near future, anything that uses electricity will have the computing capability to raise its hand on the network and say, "Hey, I'm wasting energy," or "Hey, I'm being really good," and the network will be able to adjust accordingly.
That's absolutely right. I mean, we need to know where each of the offenders are, and we need to take action on them. We can't just let them continue. In this country, energy use is going to double by 2030. And so rather than build new power plants and invest in solar and all those things which are necessary on one side, we can also reduce our energy consumption on the other side and really meet in the middle.
What's the science of figuring out how to aggregate this and make the calculations that allow us to save energy?
Well, the science is really being smart with what's going on in the physical world. So things in the physical world happen very, very fast. You can't really collect and process all that data right away and send it off to big servers. You need millions and millions of these servers. So Scintilla processes information in the real world and then sends it back and is able to look at the larger view of what's going on so that you can understand how things rank up against each other. Which pieces of equipment are bigger offenders than others? And could you replace them? Could you turn them off when you're not using them? And how much would that save you?
So it's the science of creating a database that senses quickly, has options that it can sort of rack up very, very quickly and in real time take action on.
Absolutely. And as a result, you know, reduce the overall energy consumption and reduce this problem that we're having with understanding where energy is used.
And Joe had this big smile on his face when he imagined hundreds of millions of meters all reporting together. So he took me upstairs where there was a really cool demo. Joe, this is my favorite part. Because we got these like cafeteria tables here pushed together. We got wires all over the place. But on this table with all these little lights flashing on these circuit boards and plugs is kind of the baby being born here. This is a representation of what it would be like if, I guess, 100 appliances were reporting at once to the network, right?
That's exactly right. We have all of these computers here communicating with each other, and you can see how they all connect to each other, and as they scale up, they use each other to get their information back so that we can do something with it.
So each one of these lights here represents one appliance, but it could easily be a home, it could easily be a neighborhood, it could be scaled up. How far?
Well, as far as the city or even to look across the country, the idea of Scintilla's software and the energy manager is you look at what's going on at a very fine granularity, and then you boil it up level by level to your street, your home, the city, you know, et cetera, state, and eventually across the country, know exactly what's going on throughout the energy grid.
So I'm seeing about 24, 25 nodes here. You say it could work at 100 million?
I think that's exactly what I'm saying, and that's what we need to get to.
What's the science of making it work at 100 million, 200 million?
Well, the science is that this system is very organic. Instead of it relying on lots of infrastructure, it just uses its friends, kind of bucket brigade style, in order to be able to scale up to huge, huge numbers of these actual energy monitoring management devices.
And this kind of research and development is the future as far as you're concerned?
Absolutely. Knowing exactly where energy, what you're going to do about it, people have to use this technology to reduce their energy consumption.
What used to be in this building?
Used to be a bank.
Used to be a bank. That's perfect, Joe. Joe Pilastri, co-founder of Scintilla Corporation. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We made a video of our visit to Scintilla. And, you know, these little boxes are actually like people with pet peeves about energy. They notice waste and they report it. They're actually telling on people and appliances that are wasting energy. And that's something we're asking you. If you notice buildings with lights on at night or doors open at air-conditioned stores, what do you do?
My name is Travis, calling from Manhattan, and it really annoys me to see when police officers keep their cars idling. It's our money. Why waste it?
I love that one. That's a good one. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. More of our power trip later on in the program.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Thursday, February 5th, and Mark Garrison is in with the headlines for Femi Oke.
Thank you, Dora. It's coming up on 33 minutes after the hour. We've got some fresh news, just about 3 minutes old. The weekly jobless claims are out. They went up more than expected to 626,000. And the number of people getting continuing claims, people have been claiming unemployment insurance for a long time. That's actually at a new record. Also, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar has revoked leases on federal land in southern Utah. That is a high-profile reversal of the Bush administration. The leases allowed oil and gas drilling. The auction took place in the final weeks of the Bush administration, and yesterday, Salazar directed the Bureau of Land Management not to cash checks from the winning bidders. He says he will not sell the more than 100,000 acres until the Obama administration re-examines the sale. The Senate is softening the so-called Buy America clause in the economic stimulus bill. President Obama criticized the language because he said it might spark a trade war. It stipulated that only U.S. materials be used in public works projects funded by the stimulus package. Another of President Obama's high-profile nominees will go before the Senate Intelligence Committee today. CIA head nominee Leon Panetta is a strong supporter of the president's intelligence policies and has spoken out against torture. He is not expected to face major opposition. Also going for a vote today, Labor Secretary nominee Hilda Solis. The U.S. and others are urging the Sri Lankan government and Tamil Tiger rebels to halt fighting long enough to let civilians escape from the war zone. But today, Sri Lanka's prime minister says that won't happen. The U.N. and other groups say around 250,000 civilians are trapped and dying in great numbers. The government says the rebels use civilians as human shields. The rebels deny those charges. Dora and John.
Thanks very much, Mark. Also in the headlines today, Iraqi election authorities are scheduled to give the first official results today of last week's provincial council election. They're widely expected to show gains for the law and order bloc of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. The election for regional councils that name powerful governors in 14 of 18 provinces was the first in Iraq since 2005 and the most peaceful since the invasion that toppled Saddam Hussein in 2003. For more on what's ahead in Iraq, we talked to Magdi Abdelhadi, who is the Arab Affairs Analyst at our partners, the BBC. Welcome, Magdi.
Hi.
Is the preliminary headline here that perhaps Iraqi nationalism trumped religious sentiments in this election?
Well, this is what we've been hearing, but I think it's still premature to say, and we're waiting for the first official provisional results. These will still be provisional, were due to be announced today, but that has been put off till 5 o'clock p.m. Iraqi time, which is around 8 o'clock p.m. GMT. There has been a lot of signs, if you like, but nothing is definite, that people are turning away from one of the biggest religious groups called the Iraq Supreme Islamic Council, the closest to Iran. People will read into this, are the Iraqis getting tired of religious parties? Possibly, but we still don't know whether this is a trend. And if they had voted for independence, as some of the reports have suggested, we don't know whether these independents, because there are independents with an Islamist background, that is, those who do not believe in the separation of the state and religion. It's too early to say, really, but probably we'll find out later this evening. Probably there are those who say also that may not even happen today, actually. What we heard so far, that there were some earlier results from the Anbar province to the west of Baghdad, which has been the center of the insurgency and predominantly Sunni province. And some of the issues discussed there are now that the tribal leaders who fought al-Qaeda and managed to chase him out of the province, they're all Sunni groups, of course, are unhappy about some provisional results that put another Sunni group ahead of them. They have cried foul, and there have used some very strong language suggesting they may resort to violence, but they've tried to play down this language now. And the fear
is, isn't the delay then a concern, a delay of the results a concern given some of these accusations today?
The main concern really is whether Iraqis will, or any of those who cry foul, will resort to violence and say, all right, I'm not going to play politics anymore because it's not paying off. The tribal leaders, or the spokesman, was on the airwaves yesterday reassuring everybody, saying they're going to continue to try to get redress by, if it is true that they came second and not first as they'd hoped in that province, they will try to continue to use legal means and political means. And that is, I think, is the most profound significance of this election. If Iraqis put the faith to the political process and to the ballot box to decide between them rather than carrying weapons. And if they continue to do so, that will be a sea change for Iraq and the future of the region. But that is still a very big if, and it's still too early to say.
Magdi, is it clear at all, practically speaking, why the votes have not been counted? Initial estimates said they should have some results by Wednesday.
Well, you know, Iraq, I mean, one of the complaints that have come up is that the technology wasn't working. There was power cuts. They had computers, but they couldn't link up with the central office. So it's these hiccups that are to be expected in a country that has been through what Iraq has been through.
And speaking of those hiccups, in some of the reports that you read about the elections, some have suggested that really what most Iraqis are worried about are local issues like garbage collection and unclean water.
Oh, absolutely. And that is why some of them have decided that the mullahs or the religious leaders who were there, chosen as councillors in previous elections, weren't competent. They didn't have the experience. That is why the prime minister and other politicians have campaigned on a platform of competence comes first, not which religious group you belong to. If you can do the job, then people should vote for you. And if that works, that would be really very good news for Iraq and an example to be followed across the region. It is if this election turns out to be successful and the right people are voted and they can deliver collecting rubbish, fixing the towns, then really those who argued for democracy in Iraq in the States will be vindicated. But once again, one has to emphasize it's very precarious and still violence is a very real threat in Iraq. Just today, 10 people were killed in explosions in a city north east of Baghdad. So it's still too early to say. We'll just wait not only the official results, what will happen after that and how those elected will fare. So it's an interesting process to watch for the Iraqis and for the Middle East as a whole.
Very quickly, though, this is a positive test of the robustness of this democracy, no?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you remember one of the arguments put forward by the former President Bush was to introduce democracy to the Middle East, and the bloodshed that prevailed in Iraq up until the surge was often used as, look, democracy doesn't work. And if this election proves to be successful, then Mr. Bush and his allies will have been vindicated.
Thank you very much. The BBC's Magdi Abdelhadi, Arab Affairs Analyst at the BBC, awaiting the results of the Iraqi elections over the weekend for a provisional council.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Oh, yes. We're on a power trip. I can hear it. Exploring the future of energy. I'm out here on the West Coast. Lots of you out there care about the environment wherever you are in the country. Saving energy, recycling, you know the drill. The environment is a worldwide concern. So we're asking what happens when it seems like you're the only one who's trying.
My name is Taggart. My biggest pet peeve is how some people like to have their house at 80 degrees in the wintertime, but couldn't possibly stand 80 degrees in the summertime, and want their house to be 65 in the summertime, and couldn't possibly stand 65 in the wintertime.
A lot of people are concerned about the interior weather, like retail stores that blast their air conditioning in the summer and leave the front doors of the store wide open to lure people in. It's supposed to increase their business, but they ought to lose their right to AC the store for a month when they do that. And maybe you think your own community is really green conscious. So if another city isn't, does that mean your work is canceled out?
My name is Greg Scott, and I'm calling from Rhode Island. And my pet peeve is cities like Boston and New York and other huge cities that waste lights all night long. I'd love to know what their lighting bills are.
Yeah, why is that? Or what if no matter how green you try to be, it just doesn't seem to matter?
Hi, this is Cheryl from New Jersey, and my pet peeve is that they're pushing for us to use the different type of light bulbs, but yet they have mercury in it, and we dispose of them in our landfill.
Or maybe you're the one who just can't work up the gumption to change your habits.
My name is Margie. I'm calling from Pine Bush, New York. My husband's pet peeve is that I use the dryer, and I just can't give up my dryer. He wants me to hang up the clothes in the basement. But by the time we take them off the dryer, like 2 weeks later, they're hard and stiff, and I just can't give up my dryer. But I know I'm using up a lot of energy.
We appreciate candor.
Easy for him to say.
Yeah, we appreciate candor here at The Takeaway. So what can be changed to make your life easier and also get you to save energy? Smokey emails us, I want three-way switches on every appliance. On, standby, and off. Really off. It's stupid to have to unplug something, he says, to truly turn it off.
You know, Adam, when he sees a light left on in his office, he doesn't just stand by.
I work up at the Sears Tower where I go around half my floor and shut them off every single night and still every single day when I leave.
Well, you can be green as an adult, but what about our children?
My name is Thelma Fellows. I think we all agree that recycling is energy saving, and I'm working in Head Starts, and I find they're not even bothering to recycle, and all the children have these little individual milk boxes that are entirely recyclable, but I think they're not teaching the children to recycle as well as not saving energy.
Remember years ago when green kids meant they were actually ill? No. It's a new century. What do you think people should do to conserve? Go to our website, thetakeaway.org. Check out our series, Power Trip. We have interviews, videos, and more where you can learn about the future of energy and register what bothers you when people are wasting energy in your presence.
And you know what? Note to parents, John, I think that when kids are green, they may actually still be ill.
It's true. I've had that experience.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, February 5th, and Mark Garrison is in for Femi Okeh, and he's got the headlines of the hour.
Thank you, Adora. It's 12 minutes before the hour. President Obama has signed a bill expanding the State Children's Health Insurance Program, or SCHIP. An additional 4 million uninsured children will now be covered by the government. The new measure costs nearly $33 billion. Lawmakers are paying for it through an increase in federal tobacco taxes. The Senate holds a hearing today investigating the national salmonella outbreak. They're vowing to press for stronger food safety laws and more funding for inspections. The most recent outbreak is linked to contaminated peanut products. As you know, hundreds have been sickened and several deaths blamed on the outbreak. Attorneys for baseball's Barry Bonds are expected to ask a judge today to exclude much of the government's evidence against him. He's facing perjury charges, accused of lying about whether he knowingly used performance-enhancing drugs. Federal prosecutors released evidence yesterday. Adora, John.
Thanks very much, Mark. John?
So, Adora, as the billions of dollars begin streaming out of Washington, if the stimulus package ever gets passed, that money is going to be landing in state capitals all over this United States. And joining us is the governor of New York State, David Paterson. Governor Paterson is going to be one of the governors overseeing and managing the stimulus package as it is prioritized into projects in states all over the country. And there are particular issues here in New York. Governor Paterson, to explain them, thanks so much for joining us here on The Takeaway.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Adora.
Let's just start right out. You know, the nation is hearing all about bonus caps and salary caps and banking executives not being able to get compensated at the level of like $16, $17 million. But as bonuses decline, it actually bears directly on the finances of the state of New York. Can you explain?
Well, ironically, in spite of the fact that a lot of these executives have acted irresponsibly. The fact is that for every 700, every 10% drop there are in bonuses, our state loses about $750 to $850 million. Mm. So the Wall Street bonuses were down 44% this year, and therefore our state lost billions of dollars. As a matter of fact, our budget, which was estimated at $5 billion in April 2008, wound up at $15.4 billion, three times higher than it had ever been except for one time, and three times higher than it was first estimated. And a lot of that had to do with New York depending so much on Wall Street. It's 20% of our revenues. And in the last three quarters, the last 3 months of the fiscal year, January, February, and March, where we are right now, it's 30%. It's 30% of the taxes we collect come from Wall Street.
I mean, that really sort of speaks the sort of structural change that's taking place in the relationship between the state government and Wall Street, relationships that are going to be changing in different ways all around the country, but the numbers are certainly huge here. You know, Senator Grassley was on our program just a couple of days ago saying that one provision of the stimulus package was deceitful, that giving money to bail out states who are in a Medicaid problem because of Medicaid spending and shortfalls in Medicaid spending is somehow a deceitful use of the stimulus money and doesn't amount to real stimulus. What would you say to that argument?
Well, I think that in many respects, the federal match, federal Medicaid assistance percentage, which they are going to alter to allow a lot of the states to get money back from Medicaid, is not exactly stimulus as much as it's budget reduction. It's helping with budget reduction. So Senator Grassley is probably right. But the point is, if the federal government is 40% of its fiscal stimulus is to cut taxes to try to reignite the engine of our economy by having people spend again, people aren't going to be able to spend if the states, which have such high deficits, have no alternative but actually to tax them. So you'll be giving with the right hand and taking away with the left. So what President Obama is trying to do is to forestall a deflationary period, which would lead to a 10-year recession, which is what was experienced in Japan, by simply making sure that the state can balance its budgets. And by the way, some of these senators who talk about not giving more money to Medicaid, we should remember that many of these states get 75% of their funding paid by Medicaid, and New York is one of the lower, is at the lowest level, 50%. And one other thing, and that is just basically that New York has a very high poverty rate, 10.7%, 25% higher than the national average. But Medicaid assessment is not based on poverty rate in states. It's based on per capita income. And New York State is in one of the five top states in per capita income because of Wall Street, or at least it used to be. And now, therefore, we appear to have fewer Medicaid patients than we actually do. So this statistical anomaly works against us as well.
Governor, what can lawmakers do in Washington, D.C. that would help you most in dealing with some of the issues here in New York?
Well, I understand that the lawmakers in Washington, D.C. are apprehensive, and I agree with them about giving block grants to states. However, the stimulus that comes from infrastructure, which we haven't addressed in the last 50 years, would put people back to work. New York has about 1,900 road, bridge, and transportation and wastewater treatment projects that we could get right to if we had some help from Washington. This would decrease our unemployment rate, put money in people's hands so they can start spending it again, and we think address the psychological stimulus that this country needs in addition to the physical one.
Well, let's look at that psychological confidence issue from your perspective. What kinds of jobs do you think make communities, and we've got communities upstate in New York, which are very different from New York City, downstate, and then, of course, there's the suburbs, which have a very different kind of economic model, it seems to me. What kinds of jobs in communities around the state do you think make the entire population feel better about things maybe getting better and coming back?
Well, John, I know you're originally from upstate New York, so I'm sure you're aware that upstate New York has been in recession for the last 10 or 12 years. compared to New York City. We lost 200,000 manufacturing jobs in the last decade. But we're hoping that the stimulus related to clean, renewable energy sources and research and development of, for instance, electronic storage technology, these are the types of jobs that we would hope to retrain people who were in the manufacturing industry in upstate New York. And I would say in the downstate area, with all the financial service jobs that have been lost, people would take just about any work right now. It's that dire a situation.
And when you do something like that, are there a lot of other jobs that don't maybe require the training of the laborers that, you know, sort of all sectors of the economy are going to participate in that that sort of wealth if you decide to locate a factory, say, in Rochester, which has a reputation of being a high tech center?
Well, it's actually sad right now. The libraries are having counseling and training sessions for people out of work. And it's not young people. You see people in their 40s and 50s. Trying to find means. I think people will go anywhere to find work at this point. The unemployment in most counties in New York is 7, 8, 9% now. But what we're thinking is that if there is a demonstration that people are getting back to work, our biggest problem in this country right now is that people aren't spending money. If you lower taxes, people are saving the money. And if you give back rebates, people are holding the money. After $1 trillion in credit card debt, the American public has awakened. The problem is that the government has not. We continue to spend.
Right.
But the problem is, to get the economy to grow, we need people to spend money. So as they say,
right,
the individual virtue has become the public vice.
Well, Governor, you know, you make a compelling point. People in libraries, people are turning to the government for answers here, and you're going to be providing them when that that stimulus money starts coming down the pike. David Paterson, Governor of the State of New York, thanks so much for being a part of the program this morning.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Adora.
Now, you're probably energy conscious, but what pet peeve do you have about other people wasting energy? Do you notice buildings with lights on at night?
It seems like a lot of people, when the heat's on and the air conditioning, whether you're the northeast or the southwest, leave windows and doors open as if nothing to have it all go out the window, which it literally does.
And Smokey emails us, I want three-way switches on every appliance, on standby, on, off, really off. It's stupid to have to unplug something to truly turn it off. What do you think? What's your pet peeve? Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And here's a thought for a takeaway today.
I'm concerned, ultimately, that if you kick down talent out of these places and make it harder to invest in these places down the road, the real danger is the future of private investment in any enterprise, which I think would be very harmful to all of us long term.
That's Charles Elson from the University of Delaware talking about his problems with limiting CEO pay, which is something Barack Obama is now doing for those who are accepting federal money. We're always on, and if you missed anything, like our interview with Charles Elson, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm Adora Udoji.
Look for the shovel watching link on our homepage on our website. I'm John Hockenberry, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
It's open season on Bernie.
One guy with a few friends and helpers discovered this thing nearly a decade ago, led you to this pile of dung that is Bernie Madoff, and stuck your nose in it, and you couldn't figure it out.
Yikes. Actually, it was more like open season on the Securities and Exchange Commission yesterday as lawmakers wonder why Madoff's scam went unnoticed for so long. Woulda, coulda, shoulda. Inside the Beltway, hindsight on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, February 5th. John is joining us from Los Angeles today. And boy, that Congressman Ackerman, he didn't hold back, did he, John?
It was the most entertaining congressional hearing I've ever watched. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning to you and good morning to everyone. We're going to take a look at that. We're also today have an exclusive from the New York Times on the state of forensics in this country. It's nothing like an episode of CSI. You'll see. A question about whether the stimulus package will really create jobs. We have a report on that. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
We're on a power trip this week, and it seems that the White House is, too. President Obama is expected to sign a presidential memorandum today directing the Energy Department to create stricter energy standards for household appliances. But power trips are what presidents are supposed to do, right? Before that, the president is attending a national prayer breakfast. That's where he is now. He's expected to sign an executive order for a legal review of the White House Faith-Based Partnership Office. It's part of his plan to overhaul the current White House Office of Faith-Based Initiatives. They were all put together by President Bush.
We have some new economic numbers just out this past hour. The number of new applications for unemployment benefits last week rose to 626,000. That's much higher than analysts expected. The total number of claims still remains at an all-time high. The Senate today picks up its debate over the economic stimulus bill. Some Republican lawmakers say there's too much spending in the plan. President Obama says it doesn't have to be just right.
No plan is perfect. And we should work to make it stronger. No one's more committed to making it stronger than me. But let's not make the perfect the enemy of the essential.
And lawmakers continue to add to the bill. Yesterday, they put in a measure that provides a tax credit for new homebuyers. They also voted to soften a Buy American clause to comply with international trade agreements.
President's pick to lead the CIA will appear before Congress today. Leon Panetta is not expected to face major opposition. He's actually paid his taxes. Wow. The government is also scrapping the leases of more than 70 parcels of federal land in Utah. It's been set aside for oil and gas drilling, but that's according to announcements made yesterday by Interior Secretary Ken Salazar.
The Dow opens at 79.57. It fell 1.5% yesterday. The S&P starts at 832. It was down nearly 1% yesterday. And you're energy conscious, right, John?
Oh, absolutely. Especially after being out here all week.
And we're asking you, though, do you have any pet peeves about what other people are doing to waste energy? Do you ever notice that buildings with lights on at night, does that cross your mind as irresponsible? Doors open at air-conditioned stores, perhaps. And do you wince at people leaving their chargers plugged into the wall or anything else, really? 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Pet peeves when it comes to wasting energy.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Today, our partners at The New York Times have an exclusive report on the state of forensic evidence in the criminal justice system. It's the draft of a report from the National Academy of Science that is a sweeping critique of the forensic methods used to convict thousands of people the past century. Methods like fingerprinting and blood spatter analysis, methods that many accept as fact. The report does not, and it could radically change the way America prosecutes defendants. Solomon Moore is the criminal justice reporter for the New York Times. He has the exclusive, and he joins us from St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning.
It certainly sounds like an indictment of some of the most important tools that prosecutors use to convict suspects.
Well, I think the National Academy of Sciences, they wouldn't describe what they've done as an indictment. What they've done is sort of critique the various methods that police agencies have used to prove crimes. And what they found is that a lot of these techniques that we have used for so long just don't have a great amount of science behind them.
You want to give us some examples? There was fingerprints, blood spatter analysis, things that many take as just fact when you have an expert on the stand testifying to them.
Right. Well, my understanding of what the Academy has said about many of these techniques is not that they're completely worthless, but that the police agencies haven't done enough testing. They don't have enough statistics behind these techniques to know exactly how reliable they are. With something like DNA, they can tell exactly, you know, what the chances are that the DNA found at a crime scene matches a suspect. Statistically, they have numbers that can tell them how what the likelihood of a match is. But when you take things like fingerprinting or hair analysis or footprints, they really haven't done that kind of research. And what the Academy says is that in many cases, forensic analysts have overstated the likelihood that they found matches when they really haven't any idea what the likelihood is.
Solomon, I'm wondering how this plays out in various municipalities around the country. Is the report partially saying that there's a lot of freelancing, that basically different police agencies maybe are using their own techniques for developing evidence like footprints, and that there's very little standardization, and so the truth value of a footprint or a fingerprint in one locality is possibly different than in another locality?
Right. They do say that standardization is something that needs to happen in forensics. Again, if we take the example of DNA, this is a method that came out from outside of forensics, really. It came from the clinical medical field and came into forensics from that sphere. And so there were standards in place for forensics. And in fact, in 1994, Congress passed legislation to standardize how police agencies do DNA testing. But there hasn't been such standardization in other kinds of forensics. And DNA is really just a small part of what forensic analysts do. It's like it's really used in about 10% of all violent cases. Everything else, fingerprinting, footprints, ballistics, hair analysis, blood spatter, all those things really take up the bulk of what forensic analysts do, and there aren't really universal standards for how to do those kinds of analyses.
Now, this report isn't binding, but it's certainly going to have some immediate consequences, won't it?
Well, I think a lot of people in the forensics community hope so. Others kind of dread what sort of impact it could have. The National Academy of Sciences has a very loud voice when it comes to this stuff. A few years back, it did a study on comparative bullet lead analysis, a technique that the FBI used to match the chemical signature of bullets found at crime scenes with bullets on a suspect. And the Academy found that that was just a bunk theory, that it held no weight. And in fact,
wow,
a year later, the FBI stopped using that method and had to send letters to thousands of possibly wrongly convicted people.
Solomon, you make a really interesting point. You alluded to DNA coming from scientific biology, and so the standards for that being clear. Let's talk about fiber evidence for a minute. It seems like throughout my entire career as a journalist, I've been talking about cases where fiber evidence was dominating the trial and decisive for the jury. Are you saying that fiber evidence is something concocted by forensic specialists, and there's really little scientific basis for what they do when they present this evidence?
Well, if you take something like fiber evidence, it's the Academy is not saying that there's just no way to use such evidence in a trial to prove that somebody was at a crime scene. What they're saying is that forensic scientists haven't done enough work to determine exactly how to get a proficiency rating, to know whether the person who is doing the analysis is proficient in what they do, how to train that person. There's no standardized way to do that. There's no standardized way to know, how likely it is that you do, in fact, have a match. They don't know the universe of fibers. I mean, you take something like DNA, you know, analysts know all the very they have a really good sample of what kinds of DNA are out there and the likelihood that there's a match when they find DNA at a crime scene. With things like fiber, hair, even blood, it's more difficult to do that.
Solomon, you said the National Academy of Science has a very loud voice. Is this why it's only still a draft report, even though it's been in the works for 2 years? I would suspect that law enforcement has some very strong opinions about what's come up so far.
Yeah, this report has been delayed at least a couple of times, and I'm told that behind the scenes there have been a lot of disputes about what should be in it. The National Institute of Justice, the FBI, the Secret Service, various agencies within the forensics community, they've all been kind of fighting this out. And on the other side, you have kind of mainstream scientists who are sort of see themselves as interveners here, and interlopers is what some would call them in the forensic science community. So there is a battle that has been going on for a while, but the National Academy of Sciences says that they want to release this final version sometime this month.
And they're making a very specific recommendation, aren't they, about a federal agency?
Right. That's probably the most controversial recommendation they make, which is instead of allowing local police agencies and state police agencies and various federal agencies to kind of come up with their own forensic standards, there should be something like a National Institutes of Health or a FDA for forensics, a new federal agency that would sort of adjudicate these matters before they get into the courts. What kind of evidence should be admissible, how it should be done, how people should be trained to analyze forensics and standardize this across the board.
Solomon, have you looked at your voicemail at all? I'm thinking there's probably 20,000 defense attorneys who have called you within the last couple of hours.
Yeah, I'm in St. Louis, so I haven't checked it yet, but
because this
I have a feeling you'll find some surprises.
They're going to be happy to get this final report if it looks anything like this draft report that you've reported on, right?
Well, I think they will be interested in this. I mean, defense attorneys aren't going to want to look at this very carefully. But it's not as if when this report comes out, you know, there are going to be thousands of overturned cases overnight. What's going to happen is Congress will look at this, I'm sure. Congress did ask for the report and did appropriate funds for it. You're going to have judges around the country looking at this and thinking about what sort of evidence and they should be admitting into their courtrooms and how they should be looking at that evidence. And it's going to – what I'm told is that this could have a gradual effect, but a very big effect. But it will take a while. It's not going to be something that changes criminal justice overnight.
Solomon Moore, thank you for your reporting this morning, your exclusive reporting, I might add. Solomon Moore is the criminal justice reporter for the New York Times, and today he has an exclusive, a draft report from the National Academy of Science that is a critique of the many forensic methods that are used across the country. And this morning we're wondering if you have a pet peeve about energy waste. When you see someone or something wasting energy, what goes through your mind? What is that thing that just gets on your nerves? 8778-MY-TAKE.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Oh, yeah, I'm up and running. Good morning, everyone. I'm out here in Los Angeles this morning. All week I've been on the West Coast on what we're calling a power trip, looking at all kinds of innovations that might shape the future of how we use energy. And in Mountain View, California, at the Google headquarters, Google, it turns out, is doing its own search for ways to reduce the company's power needs. They've got this huge solar array on all of their buildings to provide electricity. They've made a number of investments in some companies doing some fairly exotic things. And Google, of course, can't just have an energy efficiency guy. They've got this corporate officer who they literally call a green energy czar. His name is Bill Weil, who explained what he does.
My job is to make our operations cleaner and to do that in a way that helps the rest of the world get cleaner as well. What I've been doing since I joined about 3 years ago is trying to figure out how we can reduce our carbon footprint. And we've done a lot internally to make our operations much more energy efficient, to make our servers more efficient, to make our data centers more efficient. But we still have emissions. We still consume energy. And we have concluded that as we've looked around at the whole space of renewable energy, that there's a really fundamental problem that at some level the world isn't facing up to fast enough, which is that renewable energy is too expensive. Wind is 2 times the cost of coal today. Geothermal is about the same, maybe a little more, maybe a little less. Solar photovoltaic is 5 times the cost of coal. And so we are very focused on trying to find ways to make renewable energy cheaper, but to do that quickly.
We've been asking people all over the country this, you know, do you know how much energy you use? Do you keep track of the energy you use? Do you know what you could conserve on? And almost uniformly, the answer is, beats me. Do you know how much energy you use at Google?
Absolutely.
Down to the kilowatt?
Pretty much.
So you could answer the question, what's the energy cost of a search or a download?
Right. We could. We don't disclose exactly how much energy we use publicly because we consider that information a competitive secret that if our competitors knew, it would make it much easier for them to figure out how much infrastructure we have, how efficient it is, and be able to compete with us more effectively. But we do know, we track it, we track our carbon footprint very carefully.
How much of this strategy and how much of a green energy czar at a company like Google is a byproduct of the discovery that many high-tech companies, particularly ones that use lots and lots of servers and have enormous data centers, are actually, in this 21st century, energy hogs?
We do use energy. I would dispute the term energy hog. I think we actually are extremely efficient in what we do. And if you compare us to most other industries in terms of energy use per unit of output, in terms of some notion of economic output, so either revenue or profit, I think we are far more efficient than most. But it is partly about a recognition that we do use energy, that we all have a responsibility to make that energy use as clean as we can. And then we can't just sit around and wait for somebody else to solve this problem.
But let's do the math for a moment. I mean, if your growth is going to be sustainable as a company, the energy consumption curve that goes up is probably not sustainable. Isn't that what you're facing mathematically?
I think the world is facing that problem.
Ahead of the world.
And right now our growth rate is certainly quite a bit faster than the world's economy. But it is certainly true that continuing either for Google or for society as a whole to increase energy consumption without changing the kind of energy is not sustainable. That is a recipe for increasing emissions, increasing global temperatures, et cetera.
And so, Adora, what Google and its czar has done is to build some solar arrays. They've bought a fleet of electric cars. They have higher efficiency equipment for all of their servers, which are real energy hogs. They've also thrown millions of dollars at a company looking at windmills way up at high altitudes, sort of like giant kites. They've put money into huge solar plants that concentrate the sun's energy to produce steam and something called enhanced geothermal, as Google's Bill Weil told me.
The interesting thing about geothermal is you drill deep enough, it's hot. It's hot down there. Traditional geothermal is what people might call hydrothermal power generation. And the idea is you look for a place where there is hot water underground close to the surface. So you don't have to drill very deep. And when you drill, you get to a big reservoir of hot water. And then you pull the water out to extract the heat, use the heat to make electricity. And the idea with enhanced geothermal is you drill very deep. say, somewhere between 3 and 10 kilometers, and get to an area where it's quite warm, several hundred degrees centigrade, and then fracture the rock to create a space where you can then inject water and then cycle that water through to extract the heat. And this is an idea that's been tried, I would say, at small scale, but has not yet been demonstrated at large scale, and I think is a very attractive possibility. It's not a silver bullet, but if it can be made to work at reasonable cost, it has the potential to provide clean power virtually anywhere in the world. And furthermore, unlike solar and wind, which are intermittent, it's power that's there 24/7.
So exciting stuff. But then the discussion led to a kind of sobering reality. I mean, in the past, companies like IBM and Bell Labs would create their own laboratories to actually develop all these emerging technologies. But today, the scale, according to Weil, and expense of bringing clean, renewable energy to market is too big a job for private industry, even for a company as huge as Google.
For a company to invest in really basic research it's very hard to make the connection between that and the company's bottom line, even long term.
So just to synopsize, because it's a really crucial point, developing a transistor as important as that was, which is what Bell Labs did, is beyond the – I mean, to do the equivalent today on some of these energy questions is beyond the capability of normal corporations. The questions are more fundamental, the scaling is much too huge, and the amount of money required really means we have to enter at a different level than the industrial labs of two generations ago.
Industry can't justify spending billions and billions of dollars on things that might have a 10 or 20 or 30 year payback and might never pay back, or might pay back to society but not to that company. And that's where I think there is clearly a strong role for government to fund either collaborative industry research or university research or research at national labs to really try to drive that innovation.
It was Bill Weil, green energy czar at Google. I spoke to him at the Googleplex complex in Mountain View, California. There's a video of our visit. You can see it at thetakeaway.org and all sorts of stuff from our power trip, including a list of the top 10 unusual technologies that may power the future. Join the conversation. We're asking, what annoys you about other people wasting energy? What action do you take when you notice it with lights on at night, doors open at air-conditioned stores? Do you wince or do you do something more? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. You can be on a power trip, too.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. We have some headlines for you this morning from Mark Garrison, who's sitting in for Femi Oke.
Thank you, Adora. Coming up on 33 Minutes After the Hour, and faith is the focus at the White House today. President Obama spoke at the National Prayer Breakfast a little while ago. He talked about unity.
Let us remember that there is no religion whose central tenet is hate. There's no God who condones taking the life of an innocent human being. This much we know.
The president will also launch a review of the White House Office of Faith-Based Initiatives today. The Senate is working on the economic stimulus package this morning. It now includes a tax break of up to $15,000 to homebuyers. Democrats want to pass the bill before the week is up. Republicans want more of the spending cut out before they will vote for it. A new study is drawing a far greater link than previous research thought between an increased rate of breast cancer and the use of hormone replacement drugs. They are commonly used to treat menopause symptoms. The study followed patients who stopped using the drugs in 2002. That was when a government warning came out, and overall breast cancer rates did drop, although the maker of a leading pill disputes the findings. Adora and John.
Thanks very much, Mark. It's day three of the debate on the Obama administration stimulus package, and there are growing questions about what's in it. As the package makes its way along, lawmakers are trying to secure projects for their home districts. And some of those projects, though, do not seem to be aimed at creating new jobs. Some might call them pet projects or earmarks that President Obama promised the package would be free from. The Takeaway has partnered with WNYC Radio and ProPublica, the nonprofit group devoted to investigative journalism, for a new series of reports called Shovel Watch. Shovel Watch is an ongoing investigation of the stimulus package. And as part of our series, WNYC transportation reporter Matthew Sherman and ProPublica's Michael Graybell joined me in the studio this morning. Good morning to both of you.
Hi, Adora.
Good morning.
Michael, what did you find about these pet projects earmarks that don't seem to be creating any jobs?
Well, President Obama has made this pledge that they will be free of earmarks and free of pet projects. But when you look closely and deeper into the bill, there are dozens of these narrowly worded projects that send money to specific geographic areas or industries or where the group of contractors that could possibly benefit is very, very small.
Like, give us an example.
So one example would be there's an insurance exemption for companies that work on recreational boats longer than 65 feet. This is something that was proposed by the congresswoman in South Florida.
And that would mean?
Well, for them, it would mean that they take it as a small businessman who has to install carpet in yachts. And for decades, there's been this requirement that they carry a second form of insurance for longshoremen. And they say this is really for people who work on big ships, not the people who are working on recreational boats.
And doesn't really have anything to do with creating jobs.
Well, actually, they say it would create jobs, even though it seems very targeted to a specific neighborhood or a specific area. They are saying that that these people are losing out as yacht owners are taking their boats to other countries to get them fixed. There are other ones, though, that no one makes the argument that they're going to create jobs.
And Matthew, you've got an example of something that's going on here that doesn't necessarily seem to go straight to the purpose of the stimulus bill.
Right, and I should say this isn't an earmark per se. You won't find evidence of this in the actual legislation, but we know the MTA, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority here in New York, has said it's going to spend $500 million that it'll get from the federal stimulus bill to finish off a subway station, a very nice, very large one, 50 feet high, made of glass with a glass oculus, which is a word, architectural word for a cone, I guess, on top of that. And the point being is that the MTA has been building this, actually, and they have enough money to at least do the underground stuff, and that'll take them until about mid-2010. So in order to qualify for the stimulus money, they're going to take that $500 million, spend it now, and then summer 2010, when it gets around to building the actual above-ground structure, then they'll use the money that they've had in their back pocket all along. So the new jobs won't really kick in until summer 2010.
But why are either one of these things a bad thing if in some way they help to get business going, they keep people employed, and perhaps even end up employing more people?
I would say that it's not a bad thing, but these new jobs, in my example, won't kick in until summer of 2010. So let's level with people here. These aren't shovel-ready projects. These are shovel-ready within 18 months. And the final amount of that $500 million won't be spent until the end of 2012, 2013. We're talking about Obama's second term or someone else's first term here. Sure, there might be a need for jobs even back then, but we've got to be realistic about how long it is to create these jobs.
And when we talk about earmarks or pet projects, I mean, what are they exactly, and how are they different from just putting together a proposal to deal with any particular issue?
Well, there's this very kind of technical definition that allows the Democrats to to kind of ardently assert that there are no earmarks in this package. At the same time, the Republicans can just as, you know, fervently argue that the package is full of them. You know, there's nothing in here that says $500,000 for a teapot museum in Sparta, North Carolina. But there are things that if you sort of play the game and play the parlor game, you can kind of figure out where the project, you know, it is intended to go.
Let's talk about the parlor game, though, for a second, Michael. With all this talk about symbolism and confidence, you know, it might be the case that in some community, man, they put up the Teapot Museum in the middle of the Depression of the early 21st century, and gosh, it really pulled us all together. I mean, there's an interpretive quality here, and I'm wondering, as an investigative reporter, how do you figure out how to distinguish between, you know, potentially useful symbolism and something that is clearly so tightly targeted, it's never going to have the jobs?
Well, I mean, it's difficult. I don't think anyone has put a bridge to nowhere. I mean, there's no clear bridge to nowhere in this project. There's no clear pork project that would create no jobs. It's just things that would favor one particular district over another.
Or let me just put this in another way here, John, is that the money is going, even when it's not earmarked or guided in one way or other, it's going to localities who are making the decisions of how to spend this money. And they're making the decisions not based on how many jobs they're going to create or when they're going to create them, but because they want to finish this transit station and they ran out of money for it.
So it's really a question of transparency, I think you're both saying there. I'd like to thank my guest, reporter Michael Graybell from ProPublica, and Matthew Sherman, WNYC's transportation reporter. And we've been reporting on the economic stimulus bill here at The Takeaway as part of our series, The Shovel Watch Project. And now we're asking you to help us. We want to know how the plan is playing out in your neighborhood. We want you to share your stories online and on air, and we'll use your reporting to continue our investigation. Look for the Shovel Watch Watching link to our homepage at thetakeaway.org. And we're also asking you about energy this week. What irks you when you see people are wasting energy?
Hi, this is Kara calling. A couple years ago, I did an experiment. When I left town for the weekend, I turned off my cable TV. It really made a huge difference, the cable box itself, turning that off. It made a noticeable difference in my electric bill.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry, live in Los Angeles. So Hollywood production companies are waging a war against internet pirates who rip, stream, and swap millions of copies of movies like Dark Knight and Slumdog Millionaire. But as our next guest is going to tell you, they're losing. Brian Stelter is a media reporter for the New York Times, and he says Hollywood may be having its Napster moment on the issue of intellectual property rights. Brian, is this similar to the digital theft that hit the music business so hard? And good morning, Brian.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on. It seems that similar to the music industry many years ago when Napster mainstreamed, it seems over the past couple of years that the digital piracy, video piracy, that is, the stealing of TV shows and movies, has become similarly mainstream.
And, you know, it's interesting was what happened in the music business is the business model completely reversed. It used to be that the business was driven by the CD. Now it's actually driven by concert revenue, and the CD is more of like an add-on project.
Yeah,
the movie industry has got to be terrified of that.
The movie industry has been warning about video piracy for years. Some like to call it digital theft. They like to get the word theft in there really clearly. But it is different in some ways from the music industry. You know, the biggest difference is that the TV networks and the movie studios have seen this coming for years, and they're providing legal alternatives in ways the music industry didn't. You know, it took the music industry years to introduce options like iTunes that allow legal downloads. The movie industry and the TV industry is already really making a lot of progress on that front. So there are differences between the two, but nonetheless, the fact that piracy seems becoming become so much easier for people to do online is a worrisome sign for the Hollywood studios.
Is the fix, or the workaround, I guess, as you'd say out in Hollywood, something technological involving encryption, or is it much more of a broad political issue where nations have to manage pipelines of intellectual property?
It has to be the latter. You know, they will mount these dramatic campaigns to keep these films out of the hands of pirates until they are displayed in theaters. But once they're in theaters, all bets are off. You know, within 48 hours of the release of The Dark Knight, hundreds of thousands of people had downloaded that movie, that Batman movie last year. And we see that with most films now. So once those films are released into the theaters, really it's hard to get a chokehold. And I think that's where technology comes in. Some executives say technology is the problem, but it's also the solution. And they talk about adding road bumps on the internet to make it harder to find these files and download these files. Now, that's a controversial subject because we're talking potentially about throttling some of the broadband access that people are used to getting at home unfettered and unfiltered. But there are internet service providers that have shown some willingness to install limits on the amount of broadband people are receiving if it seems clear they're downloading illegal files.
But it is certainly true that the kind of piracy question hasn't really been dealt with in this digital age where, you know, the world is this kind of huge wireless network. And a lot of these sort of original kind of we're in the John Paul Jones era as far as this intellectual property is concerned. Brian Stelter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Stelter is a media reporter for The New York Times. His story on digital piracy is in the paper. It's an amazing story about the future becoming the present.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, February 5th. Mark Garrison is in for Femi Okeh, and he's got some headlines for us.
Thank you, Adora. 12 minutes before the hour, President Obama is talking to the media to make his case for an economic stimulus package. He interviewed with all major TV networks earlier, and today he has an opinion piece in the Washington Post. He says failing to pass a package could drag the recession out for years. The Senate is still working on it. Democrats want to vote this week, but Republicans say it needs to get cheaper before they will vote for it. While senators debate the stimulus bill, the Senate is also holding a hearing on the national salmonella outbreak. They're vowing to press for stronger food safety laws, as well as more funding for inspections. The most recent outbreak is linked to contaminated peanut products. Hundreds have been sickened, and it's also been linked to a few deaths. President Obama has signed a bill expanding the state children's health insurance program, or SCHIP. An additional 4 million uninsured children will now be covered. The new measure costs nearly $33 billion. Lawmakers are paying for it through an increase in federal tobacco taxes. Meanwhile, the president's pick to lead the CIA will appear before Congress today. Leon Panetta will testify, is not expected to face major opposition in his confirmation hearings. Also, a Senate committee will vote on the nomination of Hilda Solis for Labor Secretary. The FBI is taking another look at the Tylenol poisonings that killed 7 people more than a quarter century ago. No one has ever been charged, but agents were seen removing boxes from the home of a man who was once a prime suspect. The FBI says it received new information after media coverage during the 25th anniversary of the deaths. John.
Yep. Thanks, Mark. And as Mark mentioned in the headlines, you know, we're all here in America and on the Takeaway program this morning, we're trying to decipher and determine the effectiveness of the stimulus package that's beginning to emerge from Congress with a price tag of $920 billion. And it's the kind of thing that Americans are going to be doing over the next several years. Historians will probably be doing for generations, and economists are trying to figure out right now. And we're on the line now with Nobel Prize winning economist and Columbia University professor Joseph Stiglitz. Welcome to the show, Professor Stiglitz.
Nice to be here.
You know, I have so many questions to ask you, but it seems to me, listening to all the rhetoric coming from the White House and from Congress, that the essential principles of this stimulus are the projects have to be very visible. They have to be perceived as fair to various kinds of economic classes and industries, that there'll be maximum participation, and they need to move quickly. Are those appropriate principles for an economic stimulus plan, and does this plan meet those principles?
By and large, yes. I mean, there are a couple of other principles that economists would focus on. One of them is that it needs to create an asset that yields a return that for instance, infrastructure projects, had we invested in the new levees in New Orleans, we would have saved hundreds of billions of dollars. Now, that's an asset that would have saved us so much money. The same thing in Minneapolis Bridge. You know, there are lots of things where the returns are just phenomenal. And, you know, economists look at returns.
Well, you know, it seems like economists are having a bit of a ambivalence crisis over this, or at least maybe the policymakers are, because they seem very focused on an asset return on the financial side, i.e. restoring the banks, and a little bit oblivious to the asset return question for some of these projects around the nation. Are you seeing that?
Well, I think there is concern. I mean, on my side, I have particular concern about the almost third of the money that goes into tax cuts to households and much of the business tax cuts, because those aren't yielding any assets. So it's not getting us any return. So we are getting an increase in what we owe. We're borrowing the money, but we're not having anything to show for it at all.
But wouldn't a monetarist say that if we do, by those tax cuts, encourage people to save, we do end up creating an asset return for the dollar itself by backing, creating a larger pool of dollars for lending?
Well, the two problems with that, the important thing is that right now we're in an unusual situation. Americans have not saved as much as they should. And normally we would like to encourage savings, but this is not today's situation. The problem right now is that it's called the paradox of thrift, that because people are not spending, the economy is going into a very sharp decline. So we want to encourage spending. From my own perspective, from the perspective of an economist, you want the spending that creates an asset. But any spending generates activity. Generating activity generates jobs, and we have a positive cycle. If people don't have those jobs, then they stop spending, and we have a vicious negative cycle. So that's what we're trying to do. And unfortunately, if you give a tax cut, it's very normal with the overhang of debt that Americans have and the uncertainty that they face that they save it. But that is not what is needed at the current time.
Professor, you talk about how too much of the discussion right now about the stimulus package is backward-looking. What do you mean, and what would be a more forward-looking discussion?
Well, what you're looking for is encouraging the economy to spend money on things it needs. A lot of the backward-looking spending is bailing out banks that made bad mistakes. And as we bail out the banks, that money is just dribbling out into bonuses, into dividends. That's trying to make up for bad decisions that have been made over the last 5 years. If we were forward-looking, we would, for instance, rather than insuring the old assets, which the Treasury is reportedly thinking about doing, we would be insuring the new investments, the new loans that are made. That's forward-looking, so encouraging the banks to make new investments rather than compensating them for the stupid mistakes that they made in the past.
Well, then I guess there's an even broader question about this sort of forward-looking or backward-looking. You know, they say at the Pentagon that the generals are always fighting the last war. Are we going to learn from this episode, because it's so much of the rhetoric is about we're in uncharted waters, it's an unprecedented situation, that this stimulus is basically fighting the last depression and might not have the impact on this, very unusual set of circumstances that we're facing now?
Well, I think what we will be learning is that some of what we are doing this time has been shaped by the Great Depression. That's particularly true with the bank bailout. But banks have changed so much since the Great Depression that what we're doing to save the financial system, while it might have worked in the Great Depression, is not appropriate for the financial system that we have in the 21st wow. century. And the problem is that the reason we got into trouble is because the financial system changed. The banks stopped doing the lending directly. They moved into what was called the moving business rather than in what is called the originate and distribute. They didn't do as much, very little, of direct lending to enterprises. They were involved in securitization. So part of the problem, I think, is that some of the policymakers have not are fighting the last battle. They haven't absorbed the real changes in our financial system. Some of those changes, of course, are what got us into trouble.
Right. Well, Joe, I've got a personal question for you, frankly. You know, if we look back at long-term capital management, where a couple of Nobel Prize winners were involved in the debacle of that hedge fund, and then just sort of take a look at the circumstances of the last 18 months, have economists taken a confidence hit here, even Nobel Prize-winning economists? And do you feel that personally?
Well, I do think that much of the economics profession did take a confidence hit. The standard paradigm focused on rational expectations of people, you know, rationally approach things. It's so obvious that that is not the case. Many of the models focused on well-functioning, efficient economies. It's so clear that that's not the case.
There's plenty of work to do. There's plenty of work to do for economists looking forward.
Just to give you one more example.
Quickly.
Many economists focused on that central banks should focus just on keeping inflation down, ignoring what was happening in the financial system. And that's clearly one of the things that's gotten us into trouble. I personally...
We're going to have to leave it there. That's one of the lessons. Many more. Joseph Stiglitz, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
And Joseph Stiglitz is a Nobel Prize-winning economist and professor at Columbia University. And we had a series this week, and it's called Power Trip. Literally, John is on the West Coast exploring the future of energy. We're going to ask you about energy consciousness. Do you have any pet peeves about what other people are wasting energy on?
Hi, this is Beverly. I'm calling from Jersey City. And I just want to say that my son has taken, he's 8, and he has taken recycling to a whole new level, which is that he never wants to throw away anything because it might always be used for something in the future, which results in having a lot of candy wrappers and other things that some people might consider garbage, which he really considers useful stuff.
Well, that's an interesting trouble to have. What's your pet peeve? Go to our website, thetakeaway.org, and you can check out all of the videos and interviews that John has done and the team has done on the West Coast. I'm Adora Udoji, and John Hockenberry is on the West Coast. He'll have another report on energy innovations. That's coming up tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.